51.34.
What can we do? Oh, John, I knew this would happen. Poor mother all alone on Christmas and the children without any presents.
Well, it looks like this is in the air. Well, let's turn back so we can make the best of it. Hey, you're stuck. Hey, what a mess to be in.
John, this just can't happen.
Here, dear, you...
Are we grandmothers already?
No,
baby, go on back
this way. But why did we stop? Look out the window at all the snow. Oh, boy, this is going to be some Christmas. Do you think Santa will bring me a sled?
Now go back to sleep, dear, or you'll wake up soon. We might have a little trouble getting to grandmother's yet in the snow.
Son, don't you worry about family. We'll find us all right. He just knows where everyone is all the time, and if we have to stay here, he'll find us. Now, run back to sleep.
What are you going to do, John? We just can't stay here. We have just a few things to eat, and the only heat is in the car heater.
Well, we'll just have to make the best of it, Mary, and pray that he'll find a way, that we'll find a way out. You know, we must remember that there are thousands of persons in this world that are far worse off than us.
Yes, I know you're right. We will have to do with what we have. I know what we can do. I have some presents for the children in the car, and your old Santa Claus suit is in the bag. If we can't be at home, we'll just have Christmas here for the children.
Hey, that's a good idea. Besides, it'll give us something to do. We'll have to be quiet, though.
How long do you think we're going to have to stay here?
Well, I really don't know, but there's one thing, if that road commission don't come along with a snowplow, we won't be getting out of here soon.
Well, the wind and the snow is beginning to slow down, and if it stops, maybe we can clear out a place over under one of those large trees and build a fire in the morning. With what few things we have, we'll just cook and eat. The children will have some of their presents, and we'll tell them that Santa left the others at Mother's because his sled was so heavy with the new snow that he just had to leave some of them.
Say, that sounds fine. Oh, it isn't really too cold now that the wind has stopped. I would say it's about 30 degrees. There should be some wood over there near those trees. I don't think it'll be too wet if we can. If it is, I can get a lot.
Awake!
We'll try and get some sleep. I'll wake you up in a couple of hours and we'll get ready to surprise the kids. I'll turn off the engine now, so if it gets cold, let me know and I'll start it up again. If that blanket isn't enough, you can have my overcoat.
Well, that's fine, dear. Dan and Sue are sleeping like dolls. Now, if you go and turn off the engine, maybe you had better put your coat over them. John, wake up. There's a light down the road just a short ways. John, wake up.
What is it?
Right down the road. Then, look, it's getting close to the light. What do you think it is?
Let me see. Looks like a snowplow.
Mommy, I'm cold. What's that light out there?
It's a snowplow, son, coming to get us out. We've been stuck, son.
It's Santa Claus. He's found us. Just like you said, Daddy.
No, son. You know, that's just a snowplow driver.
Wait, John. He does have on a red suit and a white beard, too.
By golly, you're right. He does.
Selena. Oh, there you are.
Yes, sir.
Andre, where are you?
I'm here by the stove.
Andre, help me. Carol's crying again. Here, hold him for a minute.
All right. Now, what's the matter with him now? Quiet.
What do you think's the matter with him? He's hungry. Why shouldn't he cry with no milk since yesterday? And you, if you would only go to work instead of marching in your stupid picket lines and just sitting here at home staring at the wall.
Marie, you know why I don't go to work. You agreed that I should...
Never mind. At least you could go out and try to find some coal instead of soaking up what little heat there is for yourself.
I have been out already. See that sack there? That's all I could get.
Oh, Andre, I'm sorry, but it's so cold. And with the baby crying all night, I'm sorry I shouted at you, today especially.
It doesn't seem much like Christmas Eve now, does it?
No, even last year when we had so little, it was better than this. Oh, Andre, it all seems so hopeless now. There it is again, so early. I wonder how close... Here, give me the baby and look from the window. Come to Mama, Carol.
There they are. They're not too close. They're fighting over in the next street.
What's that other noise?
Well, I don't know. Oh, it's the tanks. I can see them down the alley. They're 3 blocks away, going by on the avenue.
When will it end? There. It's all right. Oh, who can that be? See who it is, Andre. I will take Carol to the bench.
Just a minute, please. Who is there?
It's me, Jan. Let me in, quickly.
Come in, Jan, come in. Here, come on, sit by the fire. It's all right, Marie, it's Jan.
Jan, good morning. You are welcome. I would take your coat, but I think you will find it more comfortable to keep it. Well, hush now, hush. Andre, will you hold Carol again? I'll see if there's any tea left.
No, Maria. Please don't trouble yourself. Here, this is for you and little Carol. Merry Christmas.
But, Jan, what? Milk. 3 cans of milk. But this is precious, Jan. I can't accept this. You are as poor as we.
Oh, never mind, Maria. It is a present. Let's say no more about it.
Oh, Jan, how can I thank you? The baby has been so hungry all night.
3 cans of milk? Let me see. American cans. Jan, where did you get them?
Where? Well, I found them.
You found them?
Oh, yes. You see, there was a Red Cross van with a big load. I found them in the street. They must have dropped off.
Give Carol to me. Here, little one. I'll pick up some milk.
In the street, huh? You will forgive me, Jan, but it scarcely seems possible.
Well, but I did, undoubtedly. Lying right in the street, the van had only just passed.
Well, very well, and we are very grateful, but I hope you're in no trouble, Jan.
Hey, me in trouble? Why, of course not. I...
Oh. So you found them, huh?
Well, Andre, I'm sorry. When I saw you yesterday at the demonstration, and you said the baby needed milk...
Open the door!
When I saw you, the saw the van parked at the warehouse this morning with no one around...
Quickly, Jan, into the bedroom.
No. If they're going to, or...
Open this door and in the state.
Marie, hide them up.
Well, Andre, how can I? I'm already...
I must open it. We shall have no door. Yes, Captain?
Lieutenant Ivanov, citizen.
Well, why do you come, Lieutenant? We've done nothing.
Yeah, my list is Andrei Kasny. Is that correct?
Yes.
You have a wife, one child?
Well, yes, sir.
Let me see your papers.
One moment. Here, Lieutenant.
Yes. Very well. Who's that?
Who? Oh, why, a friend of mine, Jan...
He did not live here?
No, but he was here all morning. In fact, he spent the night here.
But he does not live here?
No.
Very well. Your papers are in order. Comrade Corporal, give me the parcel for Kasny.
Yes, Command, Lieutenant.
Citizens of the People's Democratic Republic present you with this parcel with a generous reminder that at this time the Republic has the welfare of its citizens at heart. Men, about face, march!
What is it?
It is heavy.
Open it.
3 cans of milk. Turn. Turn.
There, that's the last ornament. Looks pretty nice, doesn't it? Now, you kids can put on the icicles. Your mother and I are going to have a cup of coffee in the kitchen.
Do a good job on the tree, will you, kids? And put some Christmas records on, Stephen. When your father and I get back, we'll open our presents, all right?
Okay, Mommy.
All right.
Well, Tom, you spent the rent money for presents. Old lug wrench will have us put out.
Oh, I don't think he'd be that hard-hearted, honey. Besides, he doesn't know we had that money. Cheer up, baby. Let's just forget our troubles for tonight, shall we? And show the kids a good time.
Okay, I'll try to forget that old Shylock, but it won't be easy. Let's go in and sing some carols with the kids.
Round yon virgin,
and now,
ladies and gentlemen, if you'll all gather around, why, we'll see what Santa Claus brought.
I'll get it, Dad. Oh, it's Simon Lundgren. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lundgren.
Step aside, boy. So, Sunbury, living it up, huh? I suppose you know why I'm here, and it's not to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Oh, Mr. Lugrant, would you like to come into our kitchen with me for a cup of coffee?
Never drink the stuff. I think we can handle it right here, Sunbury. Couldn't raise the rent, eh? But you can spend money in town like a drunken sailor. Heard all about it. Didn't figure you could make $100 in this town without me finding out, did you? Well, you'd better get out tonight and find another place to rent, because you're being dispossessed tomorrow. Understand?
Gee, Mr. Lovegrinch, you have a pretty... Oh, your whiskers are pretty and they're red. Are they real?
Of course they're real. Don't bother me, little girl. Now, Sunbury?
My name is Eve. My brother's name is Steve. Even Steve.
Even Steven, eh? Jump down, little girl, Eve. What do you got to say, Sunbury?
Well, Mr. Lovegrinch, I figured... Well, that is, I...
Would you like a little cup of eggnog, sir?
No. Eggnog? Maybe just a little. Easy on a nutmeg, though.
Oh, that's a pretty pink tie, Mr. Lugrin. It almost matches your beard, but not quite.
Like that tie, Eve. That was my Christmas present to myself. Hey, Sunbury, that's pretty good eggnog. Could I have another touch?
Why, certainly, Mr. Lugrin. Stephen, why don't you open that gift there, the one in the red box?
Why don't you call me Simon? Tom, isn't it?
Sure, Simon. Well, here's to a Merry Christmas.
Oh, Dad, the spinning reel I've been wanting. Just like Billy's, only better.
Say, my grandson gave me one just like that. How does it work? Do you know?
Sure. I've been using Billy. Here, let me show you.
Here, let me put a hit on that there, Simon.
Well, don't mind if I do. Eve, get your Uncle Simon a pencil, will you?
Yes, sir, Uncle Simon. You hold my dolly, will you?
Hey, what are you up to there, Simon? For me? Well, I'll be... Look, Ruth, the receipt for the month's rent.
Oh, Simon, you're almost as good as Santa Claus.
Oh, it's nothing, really.
Now I went downtown to see my girl sing Polly Molly Dee-Lo.
Whoa, Bessie! Howdy, mister. Mind if I park my wagon here for a spell? I'm thinking about buying me a car off of you fellers.
Certainly, sir. You can park your wagon for as long as you want. Now what can I do to help you, sir?
Well, I've been looking at that there sort of convertible out front there. 90 a month now I've been watching that.
Oh, I'm sure you mean that deluxe. Ferrison with his supersonic wheel disc and the twin chrome pipe.
Yep, that's the orange one out there. Yeah, that's her, 39 Ford, ain't she?
Well, it's a customized late 39 Ford, that's true. But it's got a 48 Merc engine with chrome dual pots, carburetors, that is, and finned aluminum heads.
Hot thing, sure sounds great. How much are you asking for?
Well, I'll tell you, sir, I'm not sure this Fairton is for sale. My partner had a young fellow, banker son he was, looking at it this morning. Don't know if he closed the deal or not. Young fellow said something as he left about getting the cash from his dad.
Shucks. Don't hardly seem fair. I was figuring on coming in first thing this morning myself, but I didn't sell the last of my taters till just a while ago. Had a good crop this year, too. Got $700 for the load.
Why, that's wonderful. You know, I hate to see a young fellow disappointed. Tell you what, let you and I go take a look at that car. And if that other young money bag doesn't show up soon, why, maybe we can make a deal. My partner's going to hate me for selling out from under him, but we can't be waiting around for these rich folks forever, can we?
Oh, I'd hate for anything to be just legal about this here, but I sure like that red paint job. Orange, ain't it? That's original paint?
No, that's even an improvement on the original. That's the new Satina Finish Lifetime Enamel, guaranteed to shine for years without waxing. Get behind the wheel, sir, if you wish. Try that power plant. Notice the ivory wheel, too, would you? Even better than ivory. That heat-processed Bakelite synthetic ivory stands up to the hardest use.
Yeah. Hey, what's this here crank for, mister?
That's the air conditioner, sir. Just a twist of the wrist opens the vent up there in front of the windshield. Presto, air conditioning. None of these newfangled push-button thoughts, eh?
Send to the radio. Just twist the dial of the station you want. None of that guesswork like those and other contraptions.
Just the way I like her, by heck. How much you asking for her, anyway?
Well, let's see. My partner came down to rock bottom for that banker fellow. Don't know why he insists on giving the stock away. I think he dropped the price to $8.75.
Oh, reckon I can't swing her, then. Guess that banker guy gets her after all. Like I said, the Taters only brought $700, and I won't be earning any more till next summer, excepting a few dollars here and there.
Well, just between you and me, sir, I used to do a little farming myself. I know how hard a man has to work in that racker profession. Now, if you won't tell anybody, I'll let you drive this deluxe phaeton away for $700 cash, that is.
Will you, mister? Well, then, here's the $700 cash.
Fine, young fellow. I'll just make you out a receipt right here and send you the title in the mail. Just write your name and address right here, if you please. And there's your receipt.
Wow, wait till Gertrude sees me drive up in this automobile. There you are, mister. I drive her right off now, eh?
She's all yours, Hiram. But first, how's about getting that, scattered wagon off the lot?
Well, I thought I'd go home and get my pa and bring him into town to drive the wagon back.
Look, AC, if that manure spill ain't out for more than 2 minutes, I'll have it hauled off the junkyard. At your...
Cave Alaska Radio Workshop presents The Steel Room, written and directed by Francie Link. The cast includes Robin Busby, John Elliott, Jewel Loftus. Sound effects by Helen Cameron.
Comrade, awake, awake.
Huh? What? Oh, Fedor, what happened? I must have dozed off. Oh, my God, my head.
Karina and I, we too have been asleep.
It was the food. They put something into the food.
Wait till I stand up. There.
The drug affected you more, Dixon. Peter and I, we...
Sure, Karina, sure. Now, where are we?
Encompassed in a room of steel.
There are no windows.
And that buzzing noise. This small room. But look, it's well equipped. Beds, food, and light. There's oxygen that comes from somewhere, too.
The comfort compensates for the size.
But how did we get here? What happened last night? Oh, think, Dixon, man, think.
The embassy. We went to see you in your hour of glory, Dixon. Remember? A party. It was given in your honor.
Yes, and we all danced. To the music. I danced with Fedor. I danced with you, Dixon. The music. It was part American. A sawdust, it was called. Oh, it was so pretty.
And then the vodka. Remember the toast? To Dixon from the Western world, who has seen and accepted the truth.
The drinks, boy, they must have spiced them up good. Yes, then they apparently put us in here. But why? What's their reason? I don't get it. Not this time.
I do not either, Dixon. But I accept it. You must accept it, too.
You are one of us now, Dixon. Your mind is cleansed. No longer do capitalistic doctrines cling to it. And to me comes happiness because of that.
Karina, remember that I am a Korean turncoat. Why I did it, I don't know. I think it must have been the mental and physical condition that I was in. But the blame lies deeper. I was weak. Anyway, I was brought to Moscow, and then I met you and Fedor, your brothers. And wait, this room. It's probably wired.
Comrade, we do not have an attitude of mistrust toward the party. The party has done great things for you. You have become, in my people's eyes, and in their minds and hearts as well, a great hero. You are the one...
Yes, Fedor, I know. But to my own people and my own country, what am I to them? I'll tell you what I am, a 20th century Benedict Arnold.
Dixon, please, do not speak of such things. You and I are together. To me, that is a matter of extreme importance. Before you, I had Fedor, my brother, and the party, my life. Now I have you. I could not wish for more.
Ah, my little Karina. And when we get married, if we get married, will they let us? Our children, will we have two or three? What if we want three and the party only wants two comrades? How will we raise our children? Will the party tell them to hate the country and the lost beliefs of their traitorous father? Tell me.
Enough, Dixon. You have made Karina weep. For her, there should be no tears. There is no place for tears. Listen to me, my friend, and you are my friend. Erase the doctrines of your childhood and completely accept ours. It will go bad for you if you do not.
Listen to Fedor. He is right, Dixon.
It is easier said than done, my little one. But yes, I will try. Forgive me for making you cry.
Oh, Dixon, of course.
My thoughts were all muddled. I wasn't thinking.
Dixon, I speak to you as Fedor, your brother. Suppress the rebellious desires within you. Survival will be better for you than most.
Survival, how essential to one's well-being. But enough. How in the devil are we going to get out of here? And why are we in here in the first place?
We will know soon enough. Time is an element that must be treated with patience. Karina, you look ill.
My brother, there are pains. My body.
My God, your face. It's an agony. What's the matter?
Lie down on the bed, little sister. Lie.
Fedor, you too? Your body, it's trembling.
Oh, I must lie down. Ah, here's the bed. Oh, there. Just a little rest. Just a little.
Hold me, Dixon.
Here, my darling. I'll hold you. There must be something I can do. I can't see you suffer like this. Damn, what can I do?
Greetings, comrades. This is to inform you of the glorious gift you are presenting to the communistic world. Our people shall speak your names with pride and sing praises of your deeds. The cause has been enlightened. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Dixon, he means us.
Yes, he does. Shh. Now listen.
In the rocket in which you are now in, you have served to further the field of science. When you reach the moon, and you will reach the moon, you will claim her for us. You will start a new world. You will conceive a race and instill in them our truth. You will.
No, no. Why us? We have served them so well. No, no, no.
We are going to die, Dixon. They have used us like animals. They do not realize that we have feelings.
Karina, there is so little time, but listen to me and listen well. This death will only be momentary. Then we will be together for always. Believe that, Karina.
I understand, my love. But tell me about your country. Will we go there to America? What is America like?
I'll tell you, little one, but first repeat after me and mean every word of it. Will you not understand? But you must reason, and you must know it in your heart. Ready?
Ready, Dixon.
Our Father.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven.
Who art in heaven.
Hallowed be thy name.
Hallowed be... Oh, Dixon, I do understand.
The University of Alaska Drama Workshop has just presented The Steel Room, written and directed by Francie Link. The cast included Robin Busby, John Elliott, Jewel Loftus. Sound effects by Helen Cameron.
That we can come to this great institution of learning. And as these have come today and passed another milestone of their life, we pray thy blessings upon them. O God, we are thankful for the privilege that we have and the freedom of learning. And we pray, O righteous Father, that we may guard that freedom with our very lives. God, we pray thy blessings upon the leaders of this great institution. Give them divine wisdom and understanding that they might ever lead the destiny of this school. Bless him who is to speak to us today. And lead us, O God eternal, for we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Members of the faculty, our graduating class, and our many friends of the university. Again, we welcome you to the 37th annual commencement of the University of Alaska. This morning we have two speakers. From two different walks of life, selected because each of them have had the courage to step out ahead of the crowd, to champion and to strive for things that they thought were in the best interest of our nation. We have asked them to speak to us today because we want to draw strength and inspiration from these men. Particularly, we want to present them to our young men and women who are graduating today. Our first speaker is Congressman Leo O'Brien of New York. Now, I don't know why a member of Congress from New York would greatly concern himself with statehood for Alaska. Yes, I said I don't know. Yes, I think I do know. That isn't quite accurate. I think I do know. But I'd prefer to hear his reasons. At any rate, concern himself he did. Had he developed as our champion and leader in the Congress. There were many discouraging setbacks, but he gathered his forces each year and came back fighting in true Irish fashion until the statehood victory was won. And now, Congressman O'Brien, it is my honor, sir, to introduce you to a small, just a small segment of your Alaskan friends.
Patting, members of the Board of Regents, members of the faculty, distinguished guests, members of the class of 59, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Patty has referred to my Irish ancestry, and one of my great weaknesses is that on very dignified occasions, are gathered together. But I have the feeling today that I have established a record even for a congressman traveling 10,000 miles in all to deliver a speech. I hope, as far as you're concerned, that it's worth the effort. I am deeply moved by the great honor which has been conferred upon me today. But I realize that in recognizing the part played by two men in the creation of our 49th state, you people are extending recognition in absentia to many others who had vital roles in this endeavor. Sometimes in the heat of political contest, in the struggle for credit among men, history is rewritten even as it occurs, and years later, the historians must struggle through masses of documents and speeches to find out where the credit lies. I think I would be remiss this morning if I did not pay particular credit to a man who is not a member of my party. I'm doing it because I have the feeling that a political campaign following this great historic event may have obscured or blurred his party. I know that in this great new state, you have many places named in honor of a distinguished former resident of my state of New York. And I am referring, of course, to Secretary Seward. I would hope when the passion of political contest vanishes that the great state of Alaska will give a corresponding honor to a present secretary in a president's cabinet. And I am referring to the Honorable Fred Seaton. I know as manager of the Alaska Statehood Bill that all our work, all our efforts would have fallen by the wayside if there was not on the other side of the political fence a man big enough to realize that it was possible for someone on our side of the fence to desire to do the right thing and not just seek political advantage. It is a signal honor to be permitted to address the first college graduation class in the history of the state of Alaska. Although I was just a little
stunned when President Patty referred to the fact that this is the 37th graduation. Because 37 years ago, 1922, was the last time I wore an academic gown. And that was the year that I was in the position these fine people in the class of 59 occupy today. You graduates were only freshmen in the fall of 1955 when I paid my first and until now last visit to Alaska. I was then, as now, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Territorial and Insular Affairs. We came to Alaska then to investigate the readiness of that gigantic territory for statehood. Many committees through the years had journeyed here on similar missions. And if some of those who greeted us in 1955 were just a little bored or disillusioned, I did not and do not blame them. Because only a few months before we arrived, the House of Representatives, by a margin, significantly, of 48 votes, had killed a bill granting statehood to Alaska and Hawaii. I have a confession to make this morning. When I went to Congress in 1952, it was a matter of complete indifference to me whether Alaska would or would not become a state, an indifference which was shared, as you know, by many members of Congress. I neither sought nor relished a place on the Interior Committee, dealing as it does with places farther from my home city, Albany, New York, than are London or Paris or Berlin. How then did the congressional freshman of 1952, who thought only of an early escape to a committee dealing with problems closer to his district, become in 1958 the author and House floor manager of the bill which added the 49th star to our flag? My first stir of interest in statehood came with the realization that as chairman of a somewhat obscure committee of Congress, I, a man from New York, had in a sense more power over your affairs than your elected delegate and your elected legislature. And I had never seen this great land over which I had so much authority. Then came resentment. Some of you may recall a bitter quarrel over whether the territory of Alaska should be given authority in the treatment of its own mentally ill, or whether we should perpetuate a system of federal control which smelled of the Dark Ages. The issue seemed simple, and those of us who fought for Alaska control believed we were doing the right, the decent, and the American thing. But from a noisome depth in our national life, I did not know existed, came wild, excited charges of subversion and treason. The hate groups of our land joined forces and carried with them a small army of the unthinking and the neurotic. I, who wanted only to help the unfortunate, found myself in the well of the House of Representatives, answering claims that we were part of a sinister plot to create in Alaska a million-acre concentration camp to which loyal people could be whisked in the dead of night, no matter where they might reside in the 48th state. Absurd? Yes. Childish? No. Because many believed those things, and the knowledge that they did not only saddened me, but lighted a torch of anger which made me resolve that a territory which could be attacked because it sought only simple justice should be rid of the shackles which led some to believe that Alaska was a colony populated by inferiors. I shall not detain you with a repetition of the strategy which won the statehood battle. It all lies, I hope, in the record, or our children to lead. Rather, I should like to speak of the pride most Americans feel that the United States now reaches to the very border of Siberia and 2,000 miles out into the Pacific. Why were our people, the people of my city and throughout the nation, so excited when we admitted the largest state into the Union, and later the exotic place which is Hawaii? I think it was their realization that our feet were not cemented in the status quo, and that the United States was not frozen in the past. The responsibilities of the other 48 states did not end when their representatives in Congress voted to add the 49th state. When I and others pleaded with our colleagues last year to give Alaska the dignity of statehood, we said that the economic benefit which would result would flow throughout the entire nation. We painted a glowing picture, perhaps too glowing because we wanted to win, of things to come from the bowels of this great land. But the state is very new. Its rich resources will not pop from the earth and leap to market by themselves. We have taken to ourselves a new brother, but he must be helped as he struggles with the immense new problems of statehood. But I am sure, very sure, that every ounce of help we give Alaska, financial and otherwise, will be repaid to the entire nation in pounds and even tons. Alaska, in my considered judgment, will in the lifetime of our children, the lifetime of these graduates, be one of the greatest and richest states of them all. I've talked so far of geographical frontiers. My special message to these graduates today has to do with the desperate need to establish another frontier, a new frontier of the American mind. A great scientist such as Dr. Teller, and great educators such as those who have brought you to this point in your desire to know, can give you facts to guide you toward fuller knowledge. A politician, such as I, must deal with less solid things. My life, in large measure, has been spent in the observation of human moods and shifting sentiments. During that period of observation, which included 30 years as a political writer, I have come to the considered conclusion that the ugliest word in our language is the word mob. Its employment raises unclean pictures in our minds, pictures of temporarily maddened men with hatred and bloodlust in their eyes, killing fellow men because of their color or creed, or even their voting proclivities. Pictures of hypnotized throngs swaying to the frenzied words of a dictator or demagogue. But I do not speak of those things today. I speak rather of mob thinking, of huge masses of our people bemused before television and buying their ideas as they would toilet soap. I speak of mass fixation, the acceptance of insinuation that all scientists are crackpots, all politicians are rogues, all educators are eggheads, and that new ideas somehow are subversive. We are approaching a point in our national thinking where indictment has become conviction and a charge a proven fact. Those who rebel and dare to challenge commit the cardinal sins. the sin of questioning the status quo, and therefore must be anti-American. We substitute labels, labels such as radical and reactionary for ideas. Every man must have a pigeonhole in any goal, though he be round and the whole square. One of the cynical bits of advice given a freshman congressman is that he participate sparingly in debates. The things you don't say, he is warned, can never be used against you. What a commentary on our times. Remain silent or the mob will throw your words back in your teeth. Repress the expression of new ideas. Let the mob turn on you for disturbing its complacency. Wave the flag, but be very, very careful about defending those parts of our Constitution which stand in the path of mob action. Assert your own patriotism, but don't bother to defend that of persons unjustly accused, because the mob might not like it. Who is responsible for this state of affairs? What elements among us have developed this passion for conformity? We have in this great nation of ours a group of self-righteous, self-appointed people who believe they or their leaders are the keepers of the public conscience. They say they are against sin, so all who disagree with their views on anything, from a local ordinance to foreign policy, must be for sin. They say they are 100% American, so all who dispute their ideas are automatically trying to destroy our country. In their arrogance, they would pin the label of treason on our highest officials, our courts, our president, and if they make a single move contrary to the dicta of their leaders. They are the anointed of the Lord, the saviors of democracy, the referees of public morals, the last voices of freedom in the land. I heard one of them on a radio program recently. He produced a guest, one of three members of Congress who had voted the way that man wanted all Congress. Those three congressmen, he said, were the only ones with the courage to do the right thing. By implication, more than 500 congressmen were cowards or disloyal or just plain stupid. I do not suggest that these people are in the majority in our land, but they are dangerous as long as the majority of us remained indifferent and allowed their policy of sterility to go unchallenged. Most of us have had the experience at a baseball game of being humiliated by the crudeness and cruelty of a few loud-voiced boors. We have cringed but remained silent, giving the impression that all of us were ignorant. That was my experience during the contest over the Alaskan mental health bill. I knew the great body of decent American opinion would be on our side, given the facts. But I still had to go through the strain and heartbreak of false accusations because the good people were silent and left the arena to the boors. I know not where life will lead you, graduates of today. You'll follow, of course, many different paths. Some of you will not see one another again. But it is my earnest hope, as you leave here with your diploma, hard-won diploma, you will also take away a common resolve to speak up when the self-righteous attack unfairly, to defend new ideas, to avoid as a very pestilence condemnation without knowledge. If you do this, you will keep open the most important frontier our nation has, the American mind. all my life, I shall be grateful for the honor given me here today. And all my life, I shall be grateful to the people of Alaska for the opportunity they gave me to place as their spokesman, or one of their spokesmen, a tiny, smudged fingerprint upon the pages of American history. The opportunity for the few years left to me of having a thrill of deep emotion whenever I see a flag pass by and know that upon that 49th star, I sewed a tiny stitch. The opportunity, if you will, of having a hobby for my old age, of autographing my grandchildren's geography book. But above all, I am grateful that you of Alaska, brought home to all of us that a nation to survive must never cease growing. Everything, be it a snowball or a mountain of granite, a man or a nation, starts to die the moment it reaches the end of growth. Thank God that we as a nation are not dying. And please God, we never will, as long as the mind of man is free to wheel and soar. Never admit, you graduates, never admit we have reached our last frontier. In that way, and that way alone, we can and will survive.
Very kind words, Bertie. Members of the faculty, friends, graduating class. Great pleasure and a great, very great honor to be here today with you. I should like to talk to you about something that lies before all of us, something that lies before you. Graduation is the end of an important experience, that of formal education. It is the beginning of work in a very, very serious sense. It is the beginning of experience, and more education that comes with experience. I do not want to talk to you about generality. I want to talk to you about my work and about my experience. And particularly, I want to talk to you about that part of the work which might have some bearing to the future development of this great state of Alaska. The president has referred to the awesome atomic energy. All the great manifestations of natural forces are awesome, and they are surprising. And most of them we meet first in their uncontrolled form. Only in the course of time do we learn that chemical energy need not be used only in firing rockets and in exploding shells, but can be used as well for driving of machinery, for useful power, and synthesis with atomic energy as well. I should like to tell you here a little about the familiar and more about the unfamiliar. We all know, we all have heard, that reactors can be built in which nuclear energy is slowly released, transformed into heat, which heat then in turn can be used to heat steam and turn machinery. We have heard about it for years. And some of these reactors are just beginning to be built. One of them here in Alaska. And I believe that these reactors might indeed play an important role in the progress of your state. Because these reactors have one particular property. In order to feed them, we do not need to bring in bulky supplies of coal or of gasoline. They will run on material which you almost could hold in your hand. And therefore, when you are trying to bring energy and the wonders that can be accomplished with energy into inaccessible places, this is a method which offers itself. I believe that within the next 2 decades, nuclear energy, nuclear reactors, will become very important throughout the world and also throughout the United States. But I believe that there is quite a chance that in many regions which today seem distant, which today seem inaccessible, these nuclear reactors will help your way to bring industry and progress. Now I should like to talk to you about something about which you may not have heard. That is, in a way, you have heard about it. You have heard about isotopes. You have heard about radioactivity. You have heard that almost every atom has a twin brother, in fact, often several twin brothers, which are radioactive, which can make their presence felt in the form of characteristic radiation, and which we all have heard it and read it and repeated it, and which are dangerous. It is these radiations about which we hear so much in the fallout question, about which so many of us are scared. I want to talk to you about the useful applications of these radioisotopes. But first, let me pause for a moment and say a word about fallout. Fallout, when it occurs in a concentrated form near a nuclear blast which has not been properly controlled, fallout can be very dangerous. But fallout, as it occurs, dispersed over the world, carefully controlled by the work of many conscientious people. This fallout contributes to radiation less than the wristwatch I'm wearing on my wrist. We know that radiation in great concentrations is harmful. The harmful nature of the exceedingly dilute form of radiation which we encounter in fallout has never been proven, and in a strict scientific or statistical sense, has never been noticed. Now this radiation, about which we are afraid, and I should say, by and large, needlessly afraid, can serve extremely useful purposes in the hands of the expert. And let me tell you one, and let me then connect it up with possible future developments in Alaska. With the help of radiation, of concentrated radiation, one can induce mutations, changes in the transmitted characteristics of living cells. One can produce mutations in animals, and I think more importantly, one can induce mutations in plants. Most of these mutations are deadly. Those which are not are usually harmful. Very, very few are such that they help. But those few which help are all important. The whole development of the living world has depended on the accidental occurrence of these helpful and progressive mutations. To experiment with these mutations, to create more animals, new animal and vegetable species, is an incredibly difficult job. Not difficult because it is intricate to make these mutations, but difficult because you have to notice when you have created something that is worthwhile. Anything that is new, that is unusual, that is irregular, is repulsive at first sight. Life, the beauty of life to our eyes, is regularity. Yes, we must keep an eye for the new, for the beauty that will be tomorrow, and for the usefulness that can serve us tomorrow. In the hands of the agriculturists, in the hands of the many people who know or can imagine how certain changed characteristics can be put to a good use, mutations can be and have been a blessing. Now we can produce more of the mutations which a few people in their laboratories never will be able to exploit to a full extent. But the many out in the field can do so. Aren't these things dangerous? Yes, they are. But so are drugs which you buy at the drug counter on your doctor's order. In fact, drugs are more dangerous because if they are lost, if they are carelessly confused from one bottle to the other, it's hard to tell them and it's hard to find them. Radioactivity, while dangerous and while not to be allowed in the hands of a person who does not know how to use it and who is not responsible, radioactivity at least has the property that it can be readily and easily identified. The completely harmless radioactivity to which I have already referred here on my wristwatch can be picked up with the greatest of ease by a simple apparatus, the Geiger counter. Now, Here you are in a new country, with your animals, with your vegetables, coming from the old world, not adapted to the short 24-hour-a-day growing season. Isn't it to be expected that this is the very place where natural changes in the course of the living things should not be allowed to occur over the millennia, but where we should intervene to create, to experiment, and to search, and to find that with which to populate the fields of this new space. Now I should change my topic again. A couple of years ago, in our Livermore laboratory, we have embarked on a discussion which to many of us seemed fantastic. Nuclear explosives, could they not be made useful rather than destructive? Could we beat this particular new and terrible sword into plowshares? Conventional high explosives have been used in peacetime as much as in war. They have been used to make transportation easier, to blast roads through the mountain passes, to clear harbors, and to help extracting the valuable minerals from our earth. All this we can do with nuclear explosives too. There are two difficulties. One is this: nuclear explosives make big effects. And where you have a big effect, you better look twice before you decide to do something. Anything new, I told you, is repulsive and frightening. Anything new that is big needs big people in order to get going with such a new thing. And big people are found in big space. Now, the other difficulty is the very same radioactivity. If you make a nuclear blast and are not careful about it, then in the vicinity of that nuclear blast, the radioactivity indeed can be dangerous. We know this danger, and we can control it if we are careful, and if we investigate with meticulous caution all the possible ways how this radioactivity can behave, how it can be carried on by the wind, where it can be deposited, what it will do inside the earth, how the groundwater will carry it along, what it will do when it gets into the sea, what will happen to it when the ocean currents will take it to new places. All these things have to be carefully considered before we can embark on any serious enterprise. These things will be considered, and we are going to spend, at least at first, while we are gathering experience, more money on precautions than we'll ever spend on the operation itself. And this is how it should be, and I feel sure, because I know that my colleagues are conscientious and careful. I know that we can and will do what we are doing, what we are going to do, with all due and certain precautions. There is, however, an even bigger possibility. Throughout the experimentation with nuclear explosives, we have gone a long way toward eliminating radioactivity. We can make these nuclear explosions cleaner and cleaner, and permitting more experimentation, I think The time is not far off where we can hope to have nuclear explosives completely clean. Then we shall be rid of a great headache, a great worry, and an otherwise permanent restriction. Well, whether we'll get rid of radioactivity completely or not, I can only hope. I cannot predict. But even if we retain some radioactivity, we scare this radioactivity will harm no one. And the nuclear explosions can be used to blast harbors in otherwise inaccessible coasts, to engage in the great art of what I want to call geographical engineering, to reshape the land to your pleasure, and indeed to break up the rocks and make them yield up their riches. It is no use to be frightened of the new forces that we have found. We must learn to live with them. Ladies and gentlemen, this is all I have come to tell you about my work, about our work with atomic energy, that might apply here in Alaska. I have put out three guesses. I might have forgotten, I probably have forgotten, the most important applications of atomic energy to Alaska, because the really important applications usually are surprises, and my imagination is not good enough. But before concluding, I would like to say a few words now about another aspect of nuclear energy, of which we are all aware. Nuclear energy can destroy. Nuclear energy has been used to snuff out the lives of thousands at the end of the Second World War, a memory which I do not cherish. Please God that by making harbors here in Alaska, perhaps near coal deposits, by exporting this coal cheaper to Japan, the Japanese might become the first beneficiaries of atomic energy, of atomic explosions, as they have been the first victims. This atomic explosion, these explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these have created a picture in the minds of all people of things that may come. A fear of war, of nuclear war, which we must strive by all means to avoid. But this is not the only fear. This is not the only worry. We are living in the midst of a world which is shaken by what some people call aptly the revolution of rising expectations. We are the haves in a sea of have-nots. We have responsibilities. There is another danger. Just across the Bering Strait, there is a vigorous, a growing country, the Soviet Union. In many respects, an admirable country. We would underestimate it, and we have underestimated it, at our greatest peril. Yet, it is a country which has historically, over the centuries, achieved its successes by coercion. and not by the respect of the individual. It is a country which has set out for world conquest. And if we are scared of nothing but war, if we are not remindful of the liberties we have to defend, we are surely going to lose that liberty. And we shall be a part of that machine, of that magnificent machine which is being built abroad, but which is a machine, and of which humans with a soul should not be part. I have come to this country from a distant land which is now under communist domination. I have talked with many people who have escaped from there during the revolution which has occurred a couple of years ago. They have not talked with hatred about the Russians, but they have told us about life under communist domination. I will not try to describe to you what they said. I have not the time, and this joyful day is not the day. I will say that if we remain prepared, the communists who are patient will not disturb the world peace either to the extent of an atomic holocaust which will drag them down together with those whom they attack. We must be prepared for war, and then war will not come. But we also must be prepared for other things. We must be prepared to win the peace. We must be prepared to get behind this revolution of rising expectations, to help the rest of the world to live in a way which fits human beings. There is a tool. There are many tools. But there is one tool in this struggle with which I am familiar, and that tool is called science. It has performed miracles, it will perform miracles, and the Russians have shown that they know how to wield this tool. We have not always done so well in recent years. We must see that all of us get familiar with this rapidly changing technological world. We must not get frightened of our own shadows as we did in this hysteria about Fallout. We must understand how to use these things. And this cannot be done except by the slow educational process which has among its rewards acquaintance with this wonderful, ever surprising, ever changing world, which in its deep, unobvious connections is much more imaginative than any fiction that you can think of. It has among its rewards a better life, a comfortable life. Not a goal in itself, but something which you need in order to be able to sit back, to think, to look and then act rationally. And it can have among its awards, if joined by understanding, by many of the human sciences, and by love, it can have among its awards peace. I should like to conclude with one word to the graduating class. In the Soviet machine, people are told what to do. They have to work hard, and if they do, the rewards are there too, although the risks and uncertainties and the privations are great. There are terrors and there are uncertainties behind that or within this machine. And in a deep sense, for the component human part of that machine, there is no dignity. We are in a different position. We believe, as you heard yesterday, and I thoroughly believe, that each person is infinitely valuable. This means a responsibility. A responsibility to learn, to understand, and to act. This time, which faces the challenge of communist domination, which faces the danger of war, could evolve into the most wonderful human achievement. Into a big, common, peaceful, and lawful family of nations. If you take your duty, your responsibility as members of a free society, if you take that responsibility seriously, we shall achieve that goal. Thank you very much.